I think if you watch the news this week, you know that there's a conflict going on in the Middle East once again. It seems once every year or two, it really heats up. Someone in the church on Facebook sent me a cartoon, and it, in a poetic way, it wasn't really showing what's actually happening in detail, but in a poetic way, it shows the attitude of perhaps the world at large in many ways. And the cartoon went like this, and there were little four cartoon strips. Hamas attacks Israel with rockets. International news, silent. The next strip is Hamas attacks Israel with rockets. International news, silent. The next strip, Hamas attacks Israel with rockets. The news, silence. The next one, Israel attacks Gaza with rockets. The news, Israel has attacked the Palestinians. That is so much the way it is. Now, it's interesting that God said the Jews would be a byword. The Jews have a certain personality to them that is, I suppose, a certain skill to them that is good in making money and the world doesn't like it. There's a certain distinct hatred toward the Jewish people. And in one sense, you can say they brought it on themselves. There was a curse. They said, we will take the punishment basically for killing Jesus Christ. Remember that when they were talking to Pilate. Let his blood be on our head is what they said. Nevertheless, we realize that when we see things like this taking place and hear of what's taking place, we know that the end time revolves around the Middle East, and we ask ourselves the question, how soon is the end going to be? Now, that enters my mind. And if you've been in the church for any length of time at all, which all of us have, then we know that back from 1949 on, there's been conflict in the Middle East. And we know also that from time immemorial, God has focused on the Middle East and Jerusalem when it comes to fulfilled prophecy. And so our minds are on that, and we're asking, when is the end of the age going to be? If you actually look up the term time of the end, it's only used a few times in the Bible. And all of them are in the book of Daniel. And it's no surprise, because when you know where the book of Daniel lies, it's in the writings, but it's a restoration book. And we'll say that a little bit more of that in a few minutes. When you look at the end of the world, that statement should be end of the age, as I was corrected on. One guy came up after services this morning and said, when is the end of the world? And I said, well, the world's not going to end. It's the end of the age. But I was just using the term that is in the Bible, end of the world. But that actual term, end world, or end ages, as it should be, is only used a few times. When it's used, though, you think, well, that's the last few years. And in actuality, one time talks about the sacrifice of Jesus Christ being at the end of the world. And you think, 2,000 years ago? But if you had lived forever, if you were around forever, then the last 2,000 years is the end of that age, isn't it? It's not that long a period of time. The other places are the end time harvest, and then the disciples ask, when is this the end of the age going to come? You know, in Matthew 24, they ask that question, and then a couple others. Well, the question I have for all of us today is, how do we really know that we are in the end time? How do we really know that? In fact, what I have here is the time of the end, the German problem. So you can see where the sermon is going to lead. The time of the end, the German problems. I decided early on in the week when I saw all the news of what's going on that it would be a good time to give a sermon on prophecy. And there's only so much you can give unless you start speculating. Then you can really give a lot, but you really get yourself in trouble too. And I have never been one to speculate. If I do speculate, I'm usually wrong. That's just the way it is. So if we stick to just what the Bible says, then we're going to stay pretty much on target. even though we may not fully understand all the details and shouldn't and won't of when Christ is going to return. We're not going to, of course, know that. But Matthew 24 tells us some of the things that we should not include as the time of the end. He said there's always going to be wars, so when we look at the Middle East and we see wars, that is not necessarily the time of the end. It might be the time of the end. It's included in the prophecies. We do know that. But just because there's a war, and just because it's going to be 52 degrees in Kansas City next Wednesday morning or Tuesday morning, breaking an all-time record for cold, you know, you can't say that the ice age is coming on and the whole North American continent is going to freeze. And that is one of the predictions of the end of the age. We can't say that. There's going to be all types of problems, as have been throughout history. So Daniel 11 actually gives us the key, along with Daniel 2, that we'll get in here a little bit later. But let's go to Daniel 11. You probably went to Matthew 24 thinking I was going there, but I wasn't. Daniel 11. Here we find in Daniel 11 definitely specific verses talking about the end time. We know Daniel 11 itself is the longest detailed prophecy in the Bible. And if any of you remember, I think it was probably a Plain Truth paper. You know, every once in a while you have articles, and so they pull out articles and they make those articles to be sent out individually. But it was on Daniel 11 prophecy. And it is tremendous detail, which helps us understand that God truly is in heaven, that he prophesied and these things came to pass. So Daniel 11, a prophecy leading up to the end time, and then we read in Daniel 11 itself at the end, starting out in verse 40, and we'll take it up to Daniel 12 and verse 4. So here we see at the time of the end. Now, if it says time of the end in this specific case, where you have prophecies leading up to, in a chronological sequence, this point, you know it's at the end time. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him, like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships. And of course, they're talking in the language of that day. He shall enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. So at the time of the end, we know that there's going to be a major military group in the north. And that would be north of Jerusalem. And then the other king of the south, if you take a look at the queen of the south was from south of Jerusalem, but it could include possibly areas that are a little bit north of Jerusalem, I suppose, but basically you're taking a look at a southern area that goes north and attacks. And it's not talking about Turkey attacking Germany. It's that wouldn't be what you're looking at. And we'll see how this has to fit in with the entire history of the prophecy that God has given. That's how you know what king of south and king of north is. We can't just pull this out without putting it in perspective with all the other prophecies. Otherwise, we're going to get in trouble, as people have throughout the ages. So you have then going through the glorious land, and so you know definitely the king of the north would be north of the glorious land because he's from up north of that. Many countries are overthrown, and it mentions those countries. He has a lot of power. He goes all the way down to Egypt in verse 43. And then news out of the east and the north, out of the east and the north. So you have eastern countries from where he is at that point, and northern countries. You have the Russians, you've got your Chinese, your Japanese, Vietnamese, Koreans, all forming together before then. And then verse 45, he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, the Mediterranean Sea probably, and Black Sea somewhere in that area, and Jerusalem. So that's where he's going to plant the headquarters at that time. So we're still talking about the time of the end. At that time, Michael will stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people, and there's going to be a time of trouble. This fits into the time of Jacob's trouble, because the same description is given. Never a time like this, even to that time, and at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone who's found written in the book. And then it goes all the way down, covering from the beginning of the millennium all the way to the third resurrection, because you can see that within verses 2 and verse 3. So, verse 4 then, but you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. So, this will not be understood, this prophecy, until the time of the end. And as we get closer and closer and see these countries developing, we will be able to read the prophecy, and those with God's Spirit will be able to understand, as we have an outline of understanding even to this day. So, the best way to analyze, now, we have what's going on in the Middle East right now, the conflict with 1,500 rockets. Is that from, which way is that going? 1,500 rockets from the Israeli side or the other side? Landing every which way but loose, because they're not directed very well. And then, of course, the Israelis counterattacking. But the best way to analyze this subject is to actually step back in history, to go back some time and then take a look at the basic prophecies that surround the end time and what's to take place in a time period that is called the end time based on the prophecy. So we have to take a look at news events in light of biblical prophecy is what we do. So again, we talk about that in light of biblical prophecy, meaning you take the Bible, you turn it on like a flashlight, and you shine it on the news, because it is the focus. It's the Word of God is the light that directs our path. I was visiting a fellow in 1967. I had just been ordained that October, I believe it was. So I was a new minister, and I was going out on my own more at that time, and there was a perspective just to the west of Toronto, and he wanted to visit. So I went out, and this fellow had a surprise waiting for me. He had a minister there, and he knew all about Mr. Armstrong. And again, what I'm focusing on is we have to step back from what's happening right now to understand the Bible. So this fellow says, you know, Germany is dead. They're never going to come back. And now this is 23 years after World War II ended, 22 years. And it's the Soviet Union. The Germans are divided. They will never again unite. And of course, they didn't. For another 20 years after that, about 22 years after that, what was it, 1989 or so, that the wall broke down? So you have a fellow who's looking at the events of the day, and he's saying, you know, a religion is only as good as its weakest link. I still remember him telling me that. And he said, the weak link in your religion is the Soviet Union is going to be the one that is there at the end time. It's not going to be the Germans at all. And of course, it didn't matter what I said when I went back to Daniel 2 and showed him the prophecies. It's like, no, what's going on right now is what is important. And sometimes we, of course, make that mistake. So we have to step back and take a look all the way back to the big prophecy that is found in this restoration book. We'll go back to Daniel 2. But we go back to Daniel 2, and we have to fit everything into the big overall outline. And this is what we have in Daniel 2. It's an outline. So if you were to map this out in an outline form, you'd say Roman numeral number 1. If there's two Roman numerals, let's say Roman numeral 2 would be Kingdom of God. Roman numeral 1 would be, and you're just kind of breaking into the story here, of course, but it would be the end or the captivity of Israel. Okay. Then after that, it would be, and beyond. Okay. Captivity of Israel and beyond. Now, A would be Babylonia. Then B would be Medo-Persia. C would be Greece. And D would be Rome. These are the four empires. So you'd have to fit everything now into that before you come to the kingdom of God. And of course, you can start back with the Garden of Eden, but now you have a lot of Roman numerals you have to deal with. So we're only going to start where I started. But Daniel 2 says in verse 44, in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom. So you know absolutely that if you want to take a look at the scenario that is functioning when Christ returns, you have 10 kings. 10 kings, the God, and we know it's 10 just because of what goes before this, the God of heaven sets up a kingdom, and that kingdom will never be destroyed. The kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all of these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. So if there is any remnant of any of these kingdoms left, it's going to smash all of them too. Inasmuch as you saw the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron, bronze, clay, silver, gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. Now, Daniel is a restoration book, as I mentioned. And it is important for us to realize that God had a reason for placing the books where he did. And it is the law, the prophets, and the writings. And within the writings, you have the restoration books. And the restoration books means restoration of the kingdom of God to Israel. To Israel. In the Jerusalem area. In the Jerusalem area. Because we can take a look at history from that time and we can say, well, look what's happened. Look what Manasseh has. Look what Ephraim has. God restored the kingdom to them, and the answer is no. The question that the disciples had when Christ ascended, or right before he ascended, was, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? And in their mind it was, you know, these prophecies of Christ returning, standing on the Mount of Olives, that's what they were thinking. Is this the time he's ascending from the Mount of Olives? We know that there's a prophecy he's going to return here. Is it really close now? Is he going to return and restore the kingdom to Israel? And we know from that area, the area where Abraham had walked and never inherited any of that land, it's from that area that the kingdom begins and stretches out over the entire world, isn't it? So we understand what they were saying. So when you come to a restoration book, it's talking about the restoration of the kingdom to Israel. Now, the Israelites don't understand that it's to spiritual Israel. It is not going to be a restoration to physical Israel. It will be spiritual Israel. And disciples understood that more because they were going to be receiving God's Spirit, but maybe not so much because the Gentiles still weren't accepted into the church, were they? They were proselytes, and there were some there, but they had to become a Jew, basically, to be accepted. Not just a spiritual Jew. They didn't understand the total concept. So we have, then, in this section here, the restoration. It is a restoration book. There's just a few of them within the writings talking about God restoring the kingdom of God. So what we have is from this time forth, from the captivity about 2,500 years ago of Israel and Judah, and this would be Daniel now and his friends coming, and as Jews, they were coming. Was Daniel a Jew? I'd have to look at his heritage again. But anyway, probably from the house of Judah. And you have them coming, and from that captivity on, it's been the times of the Gentiles. It has been the times of the Gentiles. Until Christ returns, the times of the Gentiles will remain in effect. The kingdom of God will never, or the kingdom will never be restored to Israel until Christ returns. And that's why you can read in Luke 21 what it says about until these times be fulfilled. So it's that 25-year 100-year period, with a few years where you have the Israelites being very, very dominant, a couple hundred years out of that 2,500 years, and that's about it. Okay, so we take a look then, and what we see then is verse 44, in the days of these kings, and then if you read up to it, you see that there has been an empire, this fourth empire, and it is interesting, brethren. Now, if you take a look at all the religions that are Christian religions that are into prophecy, they will say Daniel 2 is talking about the Babylonians as a head of gold, Medo-Persians, silver, and then the bronze coming down to the Greeks. And they'll say the legs of iron, beginning with the Roman Empire. But what we're dealing with here is not just the legs of iron, we're coming down to the feet. It's in the days of those 10 toes, the feet, when all of this is going to happen. And we'll get into that a little bit more here shortly too. So what's necessary for Christ's return? How do we know that we're in the end time? Well, you have to have Babylon gone. You have to have the Persians gone. You have to have the Greeks out of the way. All of that history has to be gone. And it doesn't matter what took place in the world as far as wars, as far as epidemics, as far as plagues, as far as any volcanoes erupting, as far as any earthquakes, tsunamis. It doesn't matter what happened during that entire period. Those were not signs of the end. And it didn't matter how cold it got in Russia back in 1432. You say, didn't matter any of those things. It didn't matter how many droughts came along. It wasn't going to be the time for the end. You have to get through that whole period of time. You have to come down to those 10 kings for it to be the end of the age or the time of the end. Now, of course, we take into effect or formula, I guess we could say, that the end of the age starts with Jesus Christ, but we're looking at the end of the age when you have a short period of time. 3.5 years would be what we would be looking at. So now, in the fourth kingdom, now we get to the fourth kingdom, you have the legs of iron, you have a lot of resurrections of the Roman Empire. What do we need? So what describes world events involving this fourth kingdom? And the time when Christ is going to return and smash 10 kings. Well, you have to have 10 kings. Okay, so I'm going to go through point by point here. And before you get to those 10 kings, you have to have rises and falls. So the very first point would be, you have rises and you have falls of the Roman Empire. You're going to have that. Because we do see that the Roman Empire was there when Christ was on earth. And they had taken power. Well, you go back to the time of the Persian Empire and the Persians allowing the Jews to go back to Jerusalem. And when they get back there, they end up, by the time Christ comes, under Roman rule. So the Romans have taken over by the time the Jews have established themselves in Jerusalem. And now you find that they are going to rise and they're going to fall. A few years back, I think we had the book called The Rise and the Fall of the Third Reich. How many of you remember that book? I didn't read it, but I sure remember it. So, Revelation 13, 1 through 3. Again, the first point, the Roman Empire is going to have rises and falls. It's legs of iron, but you come down to the 10 toes. So you have a lot going on before you come to the 10 toes. And we know that there's going to be a couple divisions, actually, by the mere fact there's 2 legs of iron, and we won't go into detail. You can find this in history concerning the divisions of the Roman Empire. But Romans 13, 1 through 3, I stood on the sand of the sea. I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns. Now, we're not going to find what those 10 horns are until a little bit later. It'll take you about 5 minutes, if you read fast, to chapter 17 to get to it. But there are 7 heads. And on his horns, 10 crowns. And on his heads, a blasphemous name. The beast which I saw was like a leopard, His feet were like the feet of a bear, his mouth like a mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him power, his throne, and great authority. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded. So that tells you right now this beast at the end time has been around. It had been dead or seemingly dead, and it rises again. So even though there are deaths of the empire, so to speak, where it seemed like the empire was powerless, it is going to rise again. His deadly wound was healed. Now, what I'm going to do after I go through some of these prophecies is to show you what's in the news even in the last 7 months. Because it is really telling what is happening and how you can take a dead beast and that beast can come back alive. Even though it seems that it would never rise again. So, mortally wounded, deadly wound was healed, and all the world marveled and followed the beast. Because in the past, the beast has never been followed. There's always been resistance. And there's going to come a time when there's not too much resistance against this beast. And so they worshiped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast saying, who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him? So what we have here is it is falling and it is rising. And of course, with seven heads and with the history that we have, you can go in and you can see that there have been periods of time when these nations called themselves the Roman Empire. They actually knew it. And if you go into history, as I'll show you just a little bit here later on too, there's always been a European dream of a union, and it goes back thousands of years. They've always want to be, they want to be united. And this is from the time, remember when the disciples were around, it was a Roman Empire. And there's all of these ideals in Europe that we want to be united. And so there would be a unification, and then it would fall apart, a unification that would fall apart, and they keep coming back to that. So again, it rises and it falls. Chapter 17, verse 9 and 10. Chapter 17, here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. There are also seven kings. Five have fallen, and one is, and the other has yet to come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. Now, it is interesting that this prophecy talking about the end time is talking, and it's talking with the end time in mind, even though you have a prophecy given almost 2,000 years ago. The thought is the end time, okay? Speaking forward in the future, back to the future, or whatever. That's what we're doing, back to the future. So you go to the future, you read this from a futuristic standpoint of view, and by that time, five have fallen, because when this was written, five had not fallen. And then one is, and one is yet to come. Is one. And then it says, this last one must continue a short time, which means the others lasted longer than a short time. And they did. But this one, as we pick up the context in Revelation 13 through 17, this one is only going to last about 3.5 years. It will be a short time, not a long time. So you can see then there are rises and falls. Five have fallen is what we see. Okay, then it is, back to Revelation 13, point number two, it's a military power. It has to be a military power. And with 10 kings, you know that they're combined. There's 10 kings. And of course, our mind starts working now and thinking of the time of Armageddon, any fight that takes place. So you know there's military involved. And we think right now, well, the time of the end is a long way off, because where do you find a great military in Europe? Now, you find it in Great Britain. The French have some good military. good weaponry. The United States does. But if you go to this this German problem that we that I mentioned, what do they have? They have been pacifist since the end of World War II. In fact, initially they weren't allowed to have anything. Then they were allowed to have defense. They could defend themselves. But they've been pretty well controlled. NATO is over there to keep them controlled. Initially, of course, they were divided, and that was part of the way of keeping them down so they wouldn't get together. But they've been united since, we know. So what do they have? And the answer is, if you look at what they actually own and what they could produce and whether they could go to war or not, you'd say, well, military power in Revelation 13, 4 through 7, where it says in verse 4, who is like the beast, who is able to make war with him? Revelation 13 and verse 4. I suppose the state of Montana could almost, because they haven't put away their guns yet. You have to combine Utah, Wyoming, Montana, and Texas. Those are states that aren't going to put away their guns. Not quite. I think Germany could lick those four states for sure. Although those Texans are pretty rough, I don't know. But the point is, they're not powerful right now. But there's something in the making that shows they could get powerful very quickly. They really could get powerful very quickly. Okay, so they're military power and they're untouchable at the end time. Point number three, you have to have 10 toes, 10 kings. So there has to be 10 kings that are united. 10 kings that are united. It's fragile. It'll break apart. It's part clay. It's part iron. But still, there are 10 kings that have to combine. Revelation 17 and verse 12. Now, I've gone through some of this before. I'm just trying to give you a preview. And when I give this sermon, it reminds me of what Paul said to, I believe it was the Thessalonians, or maybe those that he met in Acts. He said, don't you remember that when I was with you, I told you these things? So he was repeating what he had told them before, but we shouldn't forget some of these things. The 10 horns, verse 12. So now you have a description of the 10 horns, which you saw are 10 kings. Now that fits into the prophecy in Daniel 2, doesn't it? And this, Daniel 2 is end time. This is end time. 10 horns, 10 kings who received no kingdom as yet. Now, do we find 10 kings who've received no kingdom as yet? And the answer is, yeah, there's not much over there. There's the European Union. But as is said, you can't have a strong union without political union and military union. You have to have both. Otherwise, you don't have too much. So, there's no kingdom as yet. And we know, of course, the United States of Europe or the European Union is still groggy, I guess you could say, or it's still kind of messing around with this and that. They have Great Britain or Little Britain to deal with. And Britain is giving them problems, may step out of the union itself. So they're not together yet at all. But, now verse 12, they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. Short time. Again, it's going to be a short time. They receive authority a short time with the beast. So, 10 kings are going to combine with the beast. These are of one mind. They will give their power and authority to the beast. These will make war with the Lamb. Are these the 10 kings that will fight against Christ? And the answer is, yeah. Is this the return of Christ? And the answer is yes. He is Lord of lords, King of kings, and those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. He said to me, the waters which you saw, so now we're going to take a look back. The waters which you saw where the harlot sits up there, verses 4, 5, 6, are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. The 10 horns, 10 kings that you saw, on the beast, these will hate the harlot. The harlot is Babylon. Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots. Okay? These will hate the harlot, make her desolate and naked, eat her flesh and burn her with fire. Why? Because that's the only way they're going to combine with the beast. There's no other way. Verse 17, God's put it in their heart to fulfill his purpose, to be of one mind and to give their kingdom to the beast. So they'll have a kingdom. The ten will combine together and give that kingdom to be under the authority of the beast. And then it says, the woman is the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth, which and they won't reign too much over those kings for sure anymore. Babylon is going to fall, chapter 18. So you have to have then, as point number three, 10 kings. And we saw what's going to happen with those 10 kings. Point number four, they will establish a new economy or at least control the economy. Revelation 13, 17 and 18 is point number four. Revelation 13 and starting out in verse 17. That no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. And here's wisdom, and I'm not going to verse 18 because I don't know. I'm lost on that one. I've read descriptions of it, but trying to locate 666, exactly who that is. We know from history what has taken place with the Roman Empire, and that there has been a religion always there at the side. And we could just say that the same religion is involved here at the end time. But when we come to verse 17, we see that there's an economy involved in this, and that there's a control by the beast and the false prophet as to what people buy and what people sell. Now, I think all of you have heard of the little chip that is going to be placed in our wrist. And so when we go through Target, then we can rack up a bill because we have this little credit card. Or when we go through Walmart, you know, you just pass your wrist through it. Now, as much as that may be true, and I used to think that is a bunch of gooblygosh, that's kind of like Irish stew for those of us who are going to Ireland. But if you think that it's not possible anymore, it is so possible. It is. But it's really not talking about a chip. I don't think so at all. Maybe it'll involve a chip, but what it's really talking about here is that there is going to be a controlling government over the whole earth that will control when you work and when you don't work. Okay? And they may make you work on Saturday, but your right hand is just a symbol of work. And forehead is the way you think, and we look at now religion. So basically they're going to control your religion, false prophet, and they're going to control your work, which also has to deal with religion. That's as much as I can say. It fits into false religion. It fits into the Sabbath as a sign of God's people. And I can't see where you go too much farther than that. So point number four is, it's an economy that is controlled, a world economy that is controlled by this beast power and false prophet. And five kind of tails off that. Point number five is promoted by a miracle-working religious figure. There has to be not just a powerful political military figure, there has to be a powerful religion behind it all. And I think, was it Bernard who wrote me something about a month ago concerning, you know, what's happening in the world? And I wrote back and said, I can't remember exactly what prompted it. He may remember, you can ask him. But basically, this fellow is going to be so powerful that all the religions are going to join in. I think he'll claim to be Christian. But it's not going to be too far off when you think that Christianity is not Christianity anyway. It's, you know, all of these other things that have been brought into it. And so Hindus, Muslims, all religions of the world are going to follow this false prophet and then therefore the beast. So it'll be promoted by this miracle-working religious figure as we see in Revelation 13 once again, starting on verse 11. But let's go to 2 Thessalonians 2 here because we pick up on that. The false religion plays into this very fully. 2 Thessalonians, and it's talking about the end time because Paul wrote about that, the last chapter that he wrote in 1 Thessalonians, but 2 Thessalonians 2, where it says, look, the end time isn't here yet. Don't get concerned about it. Don't get anxious. That's verse 2. Don't be led away by letters from us as if the day of Christ had come. Don't let anybody deceive you. A falling away must come first. Man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, who exalts himself above all that's called God, sits as God in the temple of God. Don't you remember that when I was with you, I told you these things? And in the sermonette, if you would have read one verse farther down in Ezekiel, it was talking about, okay, go ahead, go in and destroy the temple. Because there's going to be the temple outside that God deals with. The temple on the temple of God, the church of God, is going to be protected overall. It's the Gentiles that are going to suffer the consequences of God's wrath. But this fellow is going to be destroyed at the coming of Jesus Christ. The man of sin who's in the court. And again, the only way, brethren, and this is, to me, it's not speculation, because when you look at this, this one cannot sit in the church of God, as far as I'm concerned. Now, I'm not going to bet you on that. The last bet I made was with a little girl as to Bob White being a bird. It was last week. Little girl, she's about 6 years old. And I said, do you know what Bob White is? And she said, yeah, it's a man's name. Because she was at camp. And I said, it's a bird. She said, no, it's not. I said, yes, it is. And she just got right up in my face. You'd have to know her. Real cute. She had her forehead right in my forehead. So if you're a 6 years old kid, beware. If you're a little boy, beware. This is going to be a stubborn wife. Comes up, puts her forehead. No, it's not a bird. And I said, yes. She said, no. And I said, I'll bet you a milkshake. She said, okay. I said, I want a Jamocha chocolate milkshake. And she said, okay. And then her dad was standing next, and he said, called out his daughter's name, it's a bird. Then she said, no, it isn't. So I called her on it. She didn't bring my milkshake today, and I don't know if I'm ever going to get that milkshake. So sometimes you make bets, and sometimes you don't, right? But on this one here, all I can say is I do not believe that it's going to be a church leader. I really think it's going to be in the court of the Gentiles, because you do find taking place in the Old Testament, the precursor to this, the type of this, when you have the abomination that caused desolation. You did not see a true minister of God causing this to happen, okay? And the priests perhaps, you know, gave in and did some things, but they weren't the leader of it. But whatever the case, what we're looking at here is a man of sin. So there are five things that absolutely must take place, must be on the scene for the end time to happen. You can go to other places here where you talk about the attacks of the King of the South. You can talk about Jerusalem being surrounded. That has to take place. And there are so many other things that we could go into, but I'll just give you those five. Now, is God correct when he gives us these points in prophecy? Is God correct? Years ago, like this minister who was at this prospective member visit, would say, no, you're wrong. This is not going to happen. Absolutely is not going to happen. Well, when we go to when we go to a 1983 book, and I would recommend this book, I know probably in the last 20 years that I've been here as a church pastor, I brought this book up probably three or four times. How many of you remember The Europeans? Good thing I'm bringing it up again. I would recommend this book. I would. It's by an author. He's an Italian author. He had insights into what is taking place, what was taking place, not based on biblical prophecy, but just based on history and based on knowing the character of the different European nations. That's why he calls it the Europeans. And he says in the very beginning, so I'll just give you a little bit to show what he saw and sees at the time concerning the European dream. He said there are so many simple and obvious reasons why the venerable, and by the way, it's Barzini is the name of the author, B-A-R-Z-I-N-I. Many obvious reasons why the venerable and illustrious countries occupying the jagged western rump of Asia, he's talking about the Europeans, the rump of Asia in this case, occasionally pecking at each other like irritable hens, in other words, they've been quarreling for years and years and years, or quarreling with the United States, should form what the Americans would call a more perfect union. So he starts the book this way because he's talking about the unification of Europe and why they should do it immediately today, tomorrow morning at the latest, without wasting one more hour or waiting for one more windy and inconclusive meetings of experts. Then he goes on to say basically how this has been a European dream throughout the ages, all the way back to Dante and even before then, that this has been a dream of Europe. And how from time to time they get it together and then it falls apart, they get it together and it falls apart. But he goes on to say that in every single European, there's the desire to bring Europe together, even the Germans, whether they know it or not. Even the Germans, whether they know it or not. So he said in order to take a look at the elusive and dangerous European situation today, this was 1983, and try to peer through the impenetrable dark future, impenetrable dark future. In other words, you can't penetrate it, but he's going to try. We know what he didn't know. It might be helpful to study the national character of the other European nations and why they have, because of their character, why they haven't combined together. The end of it, in the book, he comes right back to this. And he says, basically, the problem throughout history has been the European problem of Germany. He said the reason, basically, that you've had a problem of getting together is Germany. So he says on page 265 of a book that has 267 pages, we must admit that in a modest way, the dream of European unity has been a success. It was really conceived to prevent a recurrence of the wars of 1870, 1914, and 1939 between France and Germany. So the whole idea of bringing about a European Union, meaning bring Germany into the fold so they won't be an enemy, they'll be an ally. This is the idea of the European dream. The only way you can ever get unity is to have Germany as part of the unification. And throughout history, they've seen that Germany is kind of a pariah because of what they've done throughout all those years. So it says, this it has done. It has established a shopkeeper's ideal continental market of sorts, which has encouraged exchanges and production. It cannot go any further. There cannot be a really united Europe without a common currency, which at that time they didn't have, a common foreign policy, which they still don't have, but above all, a common defense policy, which they still don't have. Now, I'll go on with what I came across. Early this week, I decided to give the sermon on prophecy, one that I don't give too often because I stay out of trouble if I don't give prophetic sermons. But it is interesting. Der Spiegel is a German production. The article that I read the other day was July 11th. The other day would be yesterday. July 11th, and this just came along, and I hadn't even thought of going to do any history to see what's taking place, but here's an interview with outgoing NATO Secretary General Anders Våg Rasmussen. And he states, Germany should play an important role in foreign and security policy. Security meaning military. Be it in the EU, NATO, or in international politics. Then Spiegel says, so more active German foreign policy, military means included? Why would Der Spiegel ask that? Because you don't put a weapon in the hands of a German. There are too many Germans. They know that from history, right? Rasmussen says, I can understand Germany being very cautious when it comes to international military deployments because of its past. But the time has come in Germany for this debate. Europe is ready for it too. Now going on, you'll see why. Rasmussen, Germany has become such an important actor on the world stage economically and politically. It wasn't in 1945. It was a country torn apart by war, because of war. It had virtually nothing but a Volkswagen. And they still have a Volkswagen, that's good, but they had nothing at the end of the war. They were split apart. And if you, this next article that I'm going to read from, it says, Germany weighs stronger military role. Can you imagine that coming out in the news in 1946? And the answer is, man, the military would have been, it was already there. They would have closed whoever down. They would have been shot, probably, whoever would have produced such a thing. So he goes on to say, Germany's become such an important actor, it simply can't sit back when it comes to international affairs. Germany is strong, and everyone expects it to take on an active role. That is decisive for Europe's future. Going on, do you believe that German soldiers are prepared to die for Estonia or Latvia? Now, this is quite important. This, again, is the Secretary General, former, of NATO. He said, I have no doubt that a NATO country, if it is attacked, can count on the aid of all other 27 member states. By the way, this is the 100th year of the war starting in 1914, World War I, and it started over because of alliances is why it grew so big, right? If I'm attacked by them, then all the people that I've signed this treaty with will join with me and will attack those who attacked me, but the attacker will also be joined with all those who form treaties, and now you got a big war going on. Same thing happening. You have 27 countries, and it says, I have no doubt that if one of those countries is attacked, the other 26 will join in. And they actually are talking about the Baltic states here, Estonia and Latvia, which, amazing, we don't learn lessons from history. Spiegel says, so you're saying Article 5 of the NATO treaty under which an attack on one is considered an attack on all is not an empty promise? And he says, definitely not. Is NATO even capable of defending the Baltic states with its current makeup? He says, yes, we can. Absolutely. We are currently developing plans for that. And then he talked about combat drones in Germany, and the defense minister is seeking approval from Parliament right now. Then he goes on to say we need more multilateral cooperation, which we call smart defense here at NATO. And we're including now the European countries, and we're including countries that are part weak, part strong, agree, don't agree. Some countries are growing difficulties procuring military equipment on their own because of sinking defense budgets. That's why they will need to group together. And then he talks about military capabilities can truly be used for deployment. So that takes us to finally this last article that I want to mention that came out January 28, 2014. It says the new German government is charting a new course in foreign policy. The central question under the predecessor is how can we keep out of armed conflict? But now there's a change. Now two ministers, this would be the foreign minister Steinmeier and the defense minister Ursula von der Leyen, and I think that's a woman, meaning the beast is going to be a woman. That's speculation. It's probably wrong. A she-bear is worse than a male bear, is it? Whatever the case. These two new ministers, your foreign minister and defense minister, have set about abandoning the former policy of how can we keep out of armed conflict. So now we have a Germany saying, how much should we be involved in armed conflict? And that's starting January 28th, 2014. Then he goes on to say, they want to show Germany's allies that the country can be relied upon. Germany plans to dispatch more troops to support France's campaign against. So the first time they actually start supporting others with armed conflict is against the Muslims. Isn't that amazing? Against the Muslims. Now, the King of the North is going to attack the King of the South, which will be made up mostly of what? What do you think? Muslims. So I find that kind of prophetic of the future, so to speak. Going on, we want to reactivate the foreign ministry. Put it even more clearly, it's getting harder each month to justify a policy of military restraint. You know, in Acts, Isaiah 10, it says, it's not in the heart of the Germans to do this, the Assyrians, to do this, until they hit the field tomorrow against Argentina and totally destroy them. Isn't that, I've got a friend, Mr. Suckling, how many of you know him? Okay, so I wrote him the other day, we're involved in a project, and he said, do not call me on Sunday. He said, I have some serious counselings going on. And I thought, yeah, World Cup is what he has going on. So being from England, where they play true football. Although the American football, you know, you got 1 point for crossing over the line, I think you got to kick the ball after you cross the line. You got to kick the ball, football, and make your points. That's how American football started. But anyway, going on here, it's interesting when they talk about weaponry, and I'll get to this here, I think. Oh, yes, and I'll end with here. It says, von der Leyen is hopeful that Paris and London might begin reconsidering their stance given the increasing spending squeeze that all European governments are feeling. Defense budgets are shrinking, and even large countries are beginning to wonder if it is worth buying expensive transport aircraft or fighter jets. So is Germany going to buy more? Are Europeans going to buy more? And the answer is, why buy more when their ally across the border already has such planes sitting in their hangars? In other words, there's plenty out there. Why buy more? Why don't we all combine together? And once the Americans who want to lighten their burden, because that's what we said, we want to lighten our burden, trust Germany and the Europeans, do we think that we will give them the weapons that are over there? And the answer is, why not? It makes sense. It really does make sense. So what does this all mean to us? Luke 21. We'll go to the last scripture here. Luke 21. And here we find in Luke 21 that it talks about the end time in verse 20. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, Luke 21 and verse 20, then know that its desolation is near. See, that has to happen also when we know that it is an end time. But all of these other factors have to kick in too. Then let those in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of her depart. Let not those who are in the country enter her. For these are the days of vengeance, that all these things which are written may be fulfilled. Verse 24, the end time, the end of that verse, that is, Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Times of the Gentiles are not fulfilled yet. Started with the captivity of Israel and Judea, with four major Gentile kingdoms ruling until Christ returns. And when Christ returns, the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. But Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles. And in Zechariah, we find the city taken captive and half the city taken into captivity. If Gentiles are going in there and taking the city captive, will it be the Israelites who are taken captive or the Gentiles? I know it's the end of the sermon, but to answer that question, it's going to be the Israelites who are taken captive. In verse 34, take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing. Because the whole world, in fact, the priests and the ministers are going to be saying, peace, 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 peace. That's what will come out of the prophets and the ministers. Don't worry about it. Peace, peace. Things are in hand now. The Europeans are controlling things. Lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, cares of this life, and that day come on you unexpectedly. For it will come as a snare. It's going to come on quickly on this earth. Watch therefore, watch yourself, and don't be weighed down with carousing and the cares of this life. Watch and pray always that you may be accounted worthy to escape all things that will come to pass. Don't pray that you'll be accounted worthy. Pray so that you can see yourself, follow the sample prayer and everything else we're supposed to pray about, and do what we're supposed to do, and then we'll be accounted worthy. Just because I pray every day that I'll be accounted worthy doesn't mean that because I'm praying that I'll be accounted worthy, if you get the point. And stand before the Son of Man in judgment, because Christ judges. So we have to be ready. We see in all of this that God has predicted what will take place prophetically. It is coming to pass. All his other words are going to come to pass too. When he says obey, when he says to be righteous, when he talks about the hope of righteousness, then that's to be obeyed also. When he talks about eternal life, to keep the commandments, then we must keep that too. God is true to his word. So when we see what's happening in the world with Hamas and Israel, watch, know the times, and whether you live to see the return of Christ or not physically, know that still we have to do what is right.